Resurrection Is Now by Dom Elred Watkin. Death as the End Continued. The Death of the World. We live in a dying world. Just as our experience of life around us is constantly in a state of movement away from our immediate experience of it, so the very world itself, the theatre for that experience, is dying before our eyes and crumbling to pieces under the touch of our hands. In the first place, movements in the world around us partake of the same inevitable transience as does our own experience itself. The river runs past us as we stand fishing on the bank, and its waters pass out of our lives forever. There may be other waters, other days and other rivers, but that water as it flows by under those alders today has gone from us never to return. We seemed to possess it for a moment, and now it is no more. Everything is the same. The wave which we breast in our swimming passes beyond us and dies as it breaks upon the shingle. The massed clouds drive irresistibly away upon the wind, and these clouds that we see and the wind that we feel die to us for ever almost before we are aware of their brief passage. It is true that there are movements in the natural world which at first sight give a greater sense of permanence. The sun shines today much as it shone yesterday, and the stars seem to have an immemorial stability in a world of change. And yet here again nothing is really the same. What we see today we never, can never, see again. What is apparently the same is not only different to us from day to day because we have changed, it is different because it has changed. The sun may appear permanently and inevitably there and in a measure to have defeated time and alteration, but to us it has changed because we shall never see it again exactly thus. The world has moved on, and we with it, and there can be no going back, however great our desire for it may be. We cannot freeze the waterfall, hold back the wind, arrest the stars in the heavens, or halt growth. But if the world be dying to our experience, it is also a dying world. The whole of creation, even what appears to be most enduring, is subject to this law of death. The winds, rain, and frost erode continually, and with the certainty of ultimate success, the very rocks of which the world is made. The seas maintain a precarious balance between their invisible raping by the sun and their replenishment by streams and rivers. Were the balance altered ever so slightly, unfertile deserts would replace apparently indestructible seas. The very sun and stars are burning themselves out, as energy flows from them into the spaces of the sky. If this be true of what appears to be most enduring, and we think of these as such merely because their endurance is long compared with the span of human life, it is more obvious still in what is found upon the earth. Plants and flowers wither and die. Dying trees are fertilized by the dead leaves of past summers. The fruit ripens fully at the moment when it is due to die and to drop from the tree. Animals, birds, and insects are, most of them, destined to live a life of extreme brevity. Even human life is long compared with the life of the dog we trained as a puppy and which now lies buried at the bottom of the garden. Nor are human institutions or human achievements exempt from this law of death. Great empires depart, leaving no trace of the glories of their power and prestige. Civilizations fade from the memory of man, leaving nothing behind them but fragments of pottery and foundations of buildings as proof of their existence. Cultures which seemed to have shaped the world and to have immortalized the name of a people exist but as a handful of pages in a history book. Buildings begin to decay even while they are being completed. Streets once thronged with men and beasts, and houses once warm with life and laughter, now lie silent and forgotten below the sands of the desert or the brambles of a thicket. All this is obvious enough. Indeed, it is a commonplace. But it is one that would overwhelm us, did not the salvation of God give an ultimate significance, reality, and meaning which translate this dying world into a living universe and gives permanence to what is passing, indeed, gives life to the world. The death of others. Death comes to us very directly when we consider the death of others, especially if they have been close to us in love. That even the profoundest intellect must lapse into incommunicability, that the greatest beauty must go to dust, are facts that we know so well that we think we have nothing to learn from them until we are actually faced with them when those die who are close to us. Such an experience can be one of the deepest sufferings we meet with, and it is, perhaps, the stillness and silence of the tomb that gives us the profoundest pain. Surrounded, it may be, by the possessions of the dead, we long to hear once more the familiar voice or see the familiar figure walking into the room. There is so much that we would like to say. We would, perhaps, like to express our regret for our selfishness and apparent indifference in the past, to explain, it may be, that we did not really mean those cold words we sometimes used, that the offhand manner we had at times adopted did conceal a very real love. Memories give added poignancy, for the past seems so irrevocable as we ponder dead days which seem now to have been so full of promise and of hope. It is hard to talk of this, either to ourselves or to others, without appearing to indulge in almost mawkish sentimentality, for the contrast between present loss and past possession seems inexpressible otherwise than in terms which constant use has made banal. Yet those feelings, almost embarrassing to set down on paper, are part of any real human experience. We are faced by the fact that in any relationship with any person, however close, the time will come when either we will leave them or they will leave us, that each moment of being together is but one of a limited series of such hours. We know this, and we also know that, do what we may, we do not and cannot make the best of even this small stock of diminishing capital. Try as we can, to some extent, self-absorption makes us at times indifferent to the wishes and desires of those we love, and it may be that long habit has made us take another for granted. There is so much that we might have been to each other, but in fact were not. It is not that we are without reminders of all this. We are surrounded by the monuments of those who have died, for the world is a vast mausoleum. Tombs are but one of those memorials. We have the buildings of those who have gone before, pyramids, cathedrals, temples, castles, houses and earthworks. Libraries are filled with books which are the work of pens that can never write again, and museums are stored with the craftsmanship of hands now gone to dust. Indeed, outside all is fair, within are but dead men's bones, could be said of much of the world around us. Nevertheless, the salvation of God can yet articulate a voice now silent, can still bring together those apparently separated by death, can still gather up the fragments lest anything be lost. Resurrection is at hand. Death and parting are not forever. Our own death. We do not care to think about our own death. In fact, the modern world does everything it can to conceal the onset of it. We employ euphemisms when speaking of death to hide its reality. We condemn thinking about it as morbid and unhealthy. We shrink from any discussion of it. Death is regarded as the pursuer which is slowly gaining, and we do not want to listen to the stealthy tread of its footfalls. Moreover, we have become accustomed to living. We have, up to the present, always survived the dangerous illness, have always emerged alive from the nearly fatal disaster. We know we are not immortal. but we regard our own death as something that will take place in the indefinite future. That death is a real alternative to living at any given moment we can hardly bring ourselves to realize. We do not deny the certainty of death, but to us it is always then and never now. Let us look at this a little more closely. It is true that some people, perhaps suffering from an incurable mortal disease, may be able to predict with reasonable certainty when they will die. But for most of us, the fact is we shall never be more aware of our death than we are at this moment. It is hard to grasp this truth, for it is easy to compose pleasing little fantasies of our deathbeds at a ripe old age. We picture ourselves lying there, the things of time fading from our vision, and the things of eternity dawning brightly before our eyes. It is a pleasing portrait, but we may wonder how far it is true to life. Most deaths are either sudden, as in an accident, or are at the end of an illness. A sudden death is one which, by definition, makes it impossible for us to know exactly what is happening. Nor, indeed, at the present moment, can we usually bring ourselves to believe that we may die suddenly. This is something that happens to others, not to ourselves. And if we are involved in an accident that could have been fatal, we say in a rather shaken voice, "That was a near thing." But we cannot quite bring ourselves to believe that it really might have been the end of us. We are too accustomed to survival. Most people, however, die after an illness. Here again, if we look at such deaths, we can see that usually it is equally difficult to take in the fact of dying. Illness does not give such clarity. When we fall ill, we are not usually aware of any seriousness at first. We feel unwell. We tell ourselves that we are in for a bad cold or some such ailment. We take to our bed in the confident expectation that we shall soon be about again. At this point, the last thing we realize is that we shall, in fact, never go down those stairs again, never see other than what lies within the walls of a sick room, that we have already left behind us forever almost the totality of the human experience we have known. Nor are we helped to a sense of the reality of eternal truths by the course of our illness. The rising temperature, the fever, the long periods of semi-somnolence, the effects of powerful drugs, the growing inability to notice what is going on around us, the difficulty of articulation, all stand between us and a sense of this reality. There is usually no sudden insight into the transience of created things or the immediacy of the eternal. We are but ill, weary, and bemused, and thus the world passes from us. Never, then, at any point in our illness, were we really able to take in the fact that we were dying. In the early stages, no one thought of death, least of all ourselves, and in the later ones, we were not able to take it in, fully or vividly. It is a peaceful and a merciful end, but it is one which is largely unprepared. Death has been, in fact, unexpected. It will be seen, therefore, that as a general rule, we shall not have a more vivid awareness of our own death than we do at this present moment. Yet, however hard we find it to realize the possibility of death now, it is not difficult to know the certainty of death then. Death is always before us, at least subconsciously, rather in the way that some inevitable event lies ahead of us. It is in the indefinable future, but it is there. We may ignore it. We may assure ourselves that its onset is too distant for us to accommodate our way of life to it, yet at the back of our minds it remains. We would like to pretend that there is no death. This, as reasonable beings, we cannot do. We try to forget about death. This we can do for a time, even for a long time, but something happens sooner or later to remind us of its inevitability. Then, in default of forgetting, we employ our last card, that of disregarding death. The very fact that we know not the day nor the hour encourages us to consign the inevitable event to a remoteness well beyond the present. Further, we back up our disregard by a series of excellent arguments, all of which contain more than the measure of truth. If we are always thinking of death, we say, we shall merely inhibit our powers of action. We shall think that nothing is worth doing, nothing worth having. We shall become morbid and gloomy. A man cannot lead a useful and happy life if all he sees is dissolution, all he reads an epitaph. This, of course, is only too true, but it can mean two quite different things. In the first place, it can mean that though I am aware of death, I do not think about it as an end but as a beginning. Though in the order of appearances all will die, nevertheless there is an ultimate meaning and fulfilment which death cannot touch, because they reach out to a world beyond death. For me, there is no death in the sense that all ends. What we call death is but the beginning of a new life. Or it can mean, I will not think of death, because to me it is nothing but an end, a mortgage foreclosed upon human activity. If I let myself think that every step is taking me nearer to the grave, it will be a bewilderment and a torment. Such thinking would inhibit action, destroy initiative, and kill hope. Such are the possible and reasonable attitudes to death. Death is either a beginning, if a mysterious one, of a new life in which the values of the old find their fulfilment, or it is an end to all life, activity, and hope. Nevertheless, whether death be a beginning or an end, it is a fact, and it is a fact that must be faced. We cannot evade the consciousness of it save by doing violence to our own intelligence. Age is relentless in its approach. The past has gone beyond recall. The sole certainty of the future is that we shall die, that we shall leave our friends, our family, our home, and will no longer see with human eyes what has been so long familiar to us. It is the salvation of God that enables us to face this certainty not only without misgiving, but with hope, that enables us to know that intimations of immortality are not mere mirages in a desert of dust, that what has gone is not lost, and that, behold, I make all things new, is a sure and certain promise whose fulfilment we shall actually experience.